Could you please, first of all, tell me about the great trek and when you were first at university?
Well, I went to the university first in the fall of 1921. I had been out of school a year because I was a very poor mathematician, and I had failed in mathematics, and I had to write a SEP. I was a tremendous Latin scholar, but a very poor mathematician. I had obtained 92% in one of the Latin courses, but I failed in mathematics. I took them over. And I found out that we didn't have to have mathematics in agriculture. This was one of the reasons why I went into agriculture, but only one. And I've never been so happy since that I took the agricultural course. Because in those days, and I think possibly it still obtains, the courses given in agriculture are probably the widest of any courses in the whole of the university, because you've got animal husbandry, you've got soil, you've got chemistry, you've got zoology, biology, all in one. And the fundamentals today of if anybody's going to be taken to the frontier of modern knowledge, you have a better chance of getting it in the agricultural course than any other.
All right, now, could you tell me where the Great Trek started from?
Well, the Great Trek was conceived out of a campaign to move the university to Point Grey. We started in 1921 in the old shacks at Fairview. And they were shacks. There were tents there. I took my chemistry in a tent that rained when it, was wet when it rained, and was pretty miserable. The housing there was very small. I'm not sure, and I don't want to be quoted as factual in this, but I think there were less than 1,000 students in 1921, 900 and some odd, I think. There was one concrete building, and the rest were shacks. And we worked Saturday afternoon, too, because in spite of the small enrollment, the buildings were so inadequate that we had courses all the way through, and laboratories were taken Saturday afternoon in some instances. The professors worked extremely hard. The professorial staff at that time was very small. It was also magnificent, and we have some of the best educators, I think, that had largely come west when the university was established, and we owe a very great deal to them. Some of them are still living. And I was in agriculture, and there were a very small number of us. We took our classes down in an old private school on Broadway. And we were the most comfortable people of all, because it was a huge house that's still standing there. It was called Braemar, and it had been a girls' school, I think. It had fireplaces in it and so on, and we had a number of rooms, and we were probably the most comfortable of the lot. A number of the courses we had to take over at the shacks, of course, and we walked several blocks over there. Then we had laboratories at the university site in agriculture, and we took a bus. And I can remember very well, there weren't many cars on the street in those days, because occasionally the bus driver, God bless him, who was a splendid fellow, used to let the students try their hand at the wheel. And we'd have students driving the bus back and forth along Marine Drive. And I remember particularly one day when he let Maud Allen drive the bus back. And she was a little girl, weighed about 80 or 90 pounds, and we weren't too happy when that was going on. But these were the days when you didn't have the traffic on the streets, and things were a lot friendlier than they are today. They were really great days. There were troubled times, too. There were hard times as compared with now. Many of the students had to make considerable sacrifices to go to the university. They worked in the summertime. Some of them borrowed money. Borrowing money was a task in those days. It isn't anymore. Generally speaking, there was hardship, there was companionship, and friendship to a far greater extent than we experience nowadays. When you get in troubled times, that's when friendship does arise. And it was a pretty closely knit gang, and this went for the entire university. We had got in difficult times because the amount of money available to the university was not what it should have been. We had no public funds. We depended entirely on the fees, which I think I'm correct. I paid $75 fees in those days to go to agriculture, and the rest was a government grant from Victoria. And there were a great many members of the legislature at that time who were not convinced in their own mind that a university was necessary in the province of BC. There were a great many people who looked down upon university graduates as long hairs. You were impractical, you were a theorist, and therefore pretty useless in the business world, or so on. This opinion was fairly widely held. We'd come to establish a university for the first time, and there was some doubt about the efficacy of a university or its need in the province, even in 1921. Dr. Klink was our president. I do not recall the year in which Dr. Westbrook died, but Dr. Klink had become president. He was elevated from the deanship of agriculture. He had been an agricultural graduate in Ontario, and had come west to take up to open the Department of the Faculty of Agriculture here, and was promoted to the post of president. And President Klink, they say, you know, that the times find the man. And I think that the times found Dr. Klink. Dr. Klink is still living, and I hope he lives a long time. He was a great character for the university, tremendous character, and very, very solid. Because in later years, after we got out in 1925, and I think the economy of the province improved. But there was still this attitude about some restraint on what the university was worth to the people of the province. I want to tell you a story, and I have not checked all the accuracy of this, but I want you to check it. In one of these years, there was a proposal that endowments were necessary at the University of BC. And the federal government had been in negotiation with the province of BC on respect to the return of the Peace River block. A great area of the Peace River block, a great area of the Peace River, was in a federal block, had been retained from the time of Confederation, and was administered by the federal government. The federal government was handing back the resources to the provinces. This was over a period of years. It started in the 20s and ended in the 30s. And they had returned, or were in process of returning, the Peace River block to the province of British Columbia. Now, I am told, and I want you to check this up, that the great John Oliver, who was Premier of British Columbia at that time, also a very, very great man, and a great man for his times and in other ways too, had suggested that the Peace River block might well form an endowment for the University of British Columbia, set it aside, and so on. And I am told that he actually had a copy of a bill drafted, and this was going to be presented to the legislature. I do know this, that there were many members of his in the legislature, and some in his own party, who said, well, for goodness sake, if you're going to give the university anything, give them something worthwhile. That area up there is so useless that it wouldn't support a jackrabbit. Now, this I know was said in the legislature, and I am told that Honest John was so concerned over this that he withdrew the proposal and set up the university endowment lands in their place. Now, had the...
Well, they were going to get the 2 million acres anyhow, but something happened that they couldn't.
Can't tell you this. I think the bill was drafted, however you can check this. Anyway, the public opinion, or the opinion of his own members, ruled against this because they said it won't support a jackrabbit. I'm only going to suggest this, that had the University of BC obtained the Peace River block, it would have been one of the richest universities in the world. And instead, it got the endowment lands, which were nothing but trouble. And in that 1 year, I think it was 1926, the government was so imperiled for money, this was John Oliver's government still, that he made an arrangement for the establishment of a cemetery in the university area. It was called, of all things, Valhalla Cemetery. And he permitted the promoters of this cemetery to go on it, and they were doing some work knocking down the trees, and they were going to have a cemetery there. The Liberals, his own Liberals in Vancouver Point Grey, and at the Carisdale, had a giant public meeting, to which they invited John Oliver, then premier. I also was there, so I remember very distinctly what happened. And they said they had thought for a long time that John was losing his grip, but this sure proved it. The old man was really going berserk, they said, when he turned over part of the territory of Point Grey for a cemetery. Well, John came there and listened to this, and one liberal after another was getting up and saying that he was through, he was finished, he was out, and all this sort of thing. And I remember him getting up at about 11 o'clock at night and saying that he didn't want to disrupt the argument, but he promised to return to Victoria that night, and the boat left at 12 o'clock, and he'd like to have a few words before he went. So some more argument took place, and some more spoke, and then they let John get up. And he was a giant of a man, a tremendous man. He had to get special hats made. I think there were 8.5 or 9. A tremendous head and a really impressive character. And John Oliver said, "It's quite obvious to me that you people in Point Grey don't want to look after your own dead." He said, "You want to send your dead outside your own municipality," because Point Grey was then a municipality. It hadn't joined the city. He said, "If I were living in Burnaby and watched what was going on there, I would tell you people in Point Grey to bury your dead in your own backyard." Well, of course, this ended in tumult, and the meeting said that they knew the old man had gone berserk. Anyway, he went back to Victoria, and he called a cabinet meeting on Monday morning, and they bought out the Valhalla Cemetery by order in council, and I think paid $40,000 for the work that they'd already done. And then he called in some friends of his, and they developed instead the very beautiful golf course that is now there. It was going to be on that area. So this is a mark of the difficulty in which the university was. Then we get along to 1929, and there's a dreadful calamity. We had the Depression set in. And 1929, the break occurred in October 1929. 1930 got progressively worse. 1931, 32. And I'm going to say to the people of this province that they had no idea of the utter absence of money in Canada, or particularly in this province at that time. We had thousands of young men riding boxcars, and some young women too. And this was the end of steel, and they landed in BC where the weather was better, and we had a dreadful time here. And the university had a dreadful time. And the government had changed in 1928. The government changed and became the conservative government. And the Minister of Education was Canon Hinchcliffe of the Anglican Church. And Canon Hinchcliffe was an educator, but he was deemed, I think, would be recorded by most of people as a hard man, and probably he had to do these things. There was no money. The deficit was greater for 2 or 3 years in BC than the total budget was. Things were exceedingly difficult, and he elected to have a cutback in education, and one of the things that he cut back was the University of BC. Other education in the province was tragically cut back at that time. I was on a school board, and I'm going to sorrowfully admit that we cut our teachers' salaries by 30%. And we cut some of them in the larger brackets back 40 or 45%. And the tragedy of this is that the teachers never got that back when times returned until the last few years. So that we have teachers, educators, retired in this province today on scathingly small retirement allowances, whereas those that retire today are sitting pretty. This is the unfairness of all these things and the consequence of a depression. Now then, the university grant was cut back, I don't know how far, probably halved. And the president of the university, Dr. Klink, had to call his educators together, that is, his professors together, and say, "Here, you've got to take a cut." And some of them were working for almost nothing. I think that assistant professors and lecturers were working for $1,500 and $1,800 a year for one or two of those years. There was pressure for him to kick out some of the departments, and one was the department of the faculty in which I was. And they thought that agriculture couldn't be afforded. And the story was that they divided the number of graduates out of agriculture by the cost of the faculty, and they said, "You cost $40,000 a piece." And of course, this hurt agricultural graduates and so on. And there was a man who is still living, who was on the board of managers of the university, the governors of the university at that time, to whom is credited the story that it's like three men in a boat, and the boat is swamped, and they decide that only two can right the boat up and stay in it, so they decide to pick who shall drown. And he was in favor of picking agriculture to drown. Now, every graduate in agriculture and the agricultural industry in this province owes a tremendous debt of gratitude to the president of the university for holding out about against that, and said, we will all economize, we will not destroy the basis of education offered here, and we will keep the Faculty of Agriculture.
But couldn't you cut it back?
They did cut everybody back more in order to hold agriculture
but
in.
They still didn't cut agriculture back.
No, it didn't. It didn't cut agriculture out.
What? But they didn't cut it back as much as they cut back the other faculty.
No, I don't. I don't agree with that because you're dealing with percentages of what it cost. What it cost per student.
Right.
Everybody was cut back, and all the educators were cut back. All the professors were cut back, and yeah, I got it.
It's all right.
Okay.
Or you don't have to hold it.
Okay, all right. And then we also, some of us who had been graduates in agriculture, endeavored to use the good offices of the Vancouver Board of Trade, and particularly the Canadian Manufacturers Association. And a Mr. Fred Smeltz, whose widow, Mrs. Smeltz, is still living in Vancouver, started a campaign to save agriculture. And went to the industries in the province and the businessmen and said it's important to save agriculture. And as a result of that, we were saved. But it was a pretty hard years, and hard going for the professors. Now then, I got ahead of my time now, and I've got into the 30s. You wanted to know about the Great Trek. We ran a campaign. We had a very, the president of the student body at that time, I think it was Sherwood Lett, though I'm not sure and I wouldn't want to make this error. He was in the year, I think, when the idea of going to the public on the part of the student body to save the university, to get an expansion of the university, to get the university moved from the shacks, to get the buildings going at Point Grey. Now the science building, I think it's still called the science building, is the only stone building on the campus at the present time. That beautiful structure, it's the nicest building to look at, in my view, of all the buildings that are there, had been lying dormant since 1912 or 13. The concrete was poured in 1911 or 12. And then the war came, and of course nothing was done until the war was over. And that great gaunt building structure was there. And there was a movement on to get the university going again and to move it to Point Grey. And the students decided to go to the public. And they each took a piece of paper and they went from house to house canvassing. Will you sign a petition to the government of BC to move the university to Point Grey? And these petitions, which were signed by the tens of thousands of people, were very gracious. I remember knocking on the doors, and I don't think we got a turn down. Education at that level is always popular because there's some kids in the house, and they're thinking about their own children. And they signed these petitions without any question, and we got tens of thousands of signatures. So the president of the student body and a group of students went over and presented it to the government in BC. And a decision was taken, and as a result of that, the Great Trek, where we each took a pebble and threw it in, was organized, and we made the Great Trek to Point Grey, and that's where the stone cairn is today.
From where to where?
From the Fairview buildings. Started at the Fairview buildings and trekked right out to Point Grey. Yes, a long way on foot, but there were more athletic people in the university there on average then than there were today. We used to have the great run around, the long distance run around Point Grey. I don't know whether they still do it or not, but we had some good athletes at that time, and people were used to walking more than they are today. It's cars today. Every student has a car or rides with somebody that has a car. But in those days, a great deal of walking went on. In the 4 years that I went to university, I walked 2 miles every morning and afternoon to catch the old Oak Street car at Marpole. And then we went down to 12th Avenue and got off there and walked along, or Broadway, and walked along to the university. I did that for 4 years. I don't want to boast, but most of those years I got up and milked cows before that at 5 o'clock in the morning. And others did that. There were most eventful times.
Can you remember any events or any amusing things that happened while you were a student?
Oh, we had a lot.
On the campus?
Yes, we had a lot of, had a lot of interesting things. We used to get visiting speakers. And quite often they were held up to ridicule, and there were signs put up before they came, and this sort of thing, and there was a lot of horseplay went on. I think far more horseplay than today.
Like what?
Oh, well, ridiculing the staff, professors, and so on. Most of them took it in good humor. But the occasional one didn't. I remember that on one occasion there were about 15 of us in a classroom down on Broadway, and one of the professors said, now I want to tell you guys right here and now, if there's going to be two bosses in this room, I'm going to be both of them. However, he was unusual in that case. The tremendous shift from a disciplined high school to the freedom of a university was what bothered most of us, and I still think it bothers students, and I think some of them can't stand it. You're on your own. We found we were on our own, and if you missed classes, that was your responsibility. A great deal of new freedom was suddenly thrust upon students, and I noticed this particularly. It's up to you. And as a matter of fact, that's the motto of the university, isn't it? Tuum est, it's yours. Some people say it means it's yours, and other people say it's up to you. But the character of that change was what is recorded in my mind. There were great times. You see, it was my good fortune because I was young then. I was born in 1904.
So in 1921 you were 17?
I was 17 was. I was born in 1904. In 1921, that's right, I was 17 years of age. And those of us who came in at that age found that we were in a mature group because we got the benefit of all the returning veterans from the First War. And it was a tremendous experience for us who are of younger age to come in with that group. I don't want to mention them, but there was Sherwood Lett, Mr. Justice Lord. There's a whole group of them. And we had the benefit of meeting this older group who had the terrifying experiences of the war and all that that entails. And there were some great characters there. Brick McLeod was another. Brick had lost a leg overseas. But Brick could play soccer as well as anybody on that one leg in those days. It was a tremendously active and interesting and exciting time.
Where did they play soccer?
We used King Edward grounds, I guess. King Edward High School grounds, I think. That's where the soccer was held. And we had great soccer teams. In 1 year, we won the Canadian Soccer Championship at the University of BC. We had some great players. Some of them are still around. Some went into the ministry, like Lauren Baker. And there was another chap, I should remember his name, who was also a ministry. Some of these people had come from England. They'd returned with the veterans to Canada. And they're still around here in their older age now, but it was a magnificent group of people.
Do you want to turn that off for a second, Elmer?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. How much is your time is there left on?
Well, there's only about 3 minutes left here.
All right, okay. Let's do it.
Well, I'm going to take
it. Impressions? You asked me about impressions of professors. We had, as I say, a tremendous staff at that time. We'd drawn them from wide sources. In agriculture, we had Dean Clement, who is still around, and Dr. Bars in horticulture. We had Paul Boving, a Swede from Uppsala in Sweden, a philosopher in addition to being a very, very good professor. And Boving used to tell the young agriculturists how to become rich. This was to work hard, know their agriculture, and then marry the daughter of a wealthy farmer and get the farm. These are the things that... And in dairying, We had some remarkable people, too. People who have sent students out that are have made names for themselves all over the world. And indeed, this happened in the university as a whole. Mining. Do you know that some of the best known mining names in the world today came out of this university, and they're all over the globe? A lot of them went to South Africa.
Back we had to
right. We had great professors, a great array of scholarship at that time. The Dean Brock of engineer, not science. Dean Brock of science. He had been a world figure in engineering before he came here. How we were able to obtain, probably it was because we were a new university, we were able to obtain the caliber of people that came to us, I don't know. And then probably the president was responsible too, Dr. Westbrook first and Dr. Klink later. But certainly the caliber of people was extremely high.
How were they able to sustain the caliber during the crises, though?
It was very, loyalty, I'll tell you how. These men could have gone elsewhere. Very few of them went. Had they gone, they'd have probably gone to the United States because even though they had a depression there, I think that their educational pay was higher there. But these men were loyal, and they saw the future of the university and they waited for it.